everyone. Welcome to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Espinoza, the managing editor of Turbo Machinery International. On today's show, we are tackling the turbo machinery design process. And with me are the Mythbusters, Klaus Brunn and Reiner Kurtz. They are going to give our listeners an overview of engineering tools used to design turbo machines and dive into whether they are over-relied upon and their accuracy as well as training. So good morning to you both, and thank you for hopping on today.
Thank you for having us again. This is Klaus. I'm happy to be on this for, I don't know, the 15th or 20th time. It's always a lot of fun talking about these really relevant turbo machinery related topics.
Yeah, hi, this is Reiner Kurtz. Actually, this is going to be a very interesting discussion, in particular because both Klaus and I are doing stuff like that for a living, or used to do stuff like that for a living.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this too. So why don't you kick us off by describing, you know, the typical design process of a turbo machine and what engineering tools are required?
Okay, I can kind of jump into this. I'm going to, I guess, talk about compressors, but the approach similarly applies to expanders, turbines, et cetera. So, I mean, usually it's something like from, you know, very coarse to refined, right? And so that's kind of what you learn in school. You start with, you know, what's called a 1D analysis and then a 2D analysis, which is also called a blade passage flow analysis. Then you get into 3D, then you do some testing, and then you refine your geometry. In reality, and that's really the aerodynamics, right? In reality, there is also the first step, which is often overlooked, which is really your experience, right? You start a design from what your experience is, what your existing machinery portfolio is. So if you are a turbo machinery manufacturer, you've worked in an area for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, you certainly have done a lot of different types of machines. So before you design a new machine, a new design process or a new impeller or a new expander, you look at your existing portfolio, and that's usually your starting point. And so then you go through those steps after you kind of looked at what's closest to what I need from my existing portfolio. Can I start with this? Do I have to start from scratch? Additionally to that, and that just kind of describes the aerodynamic design process, there's also the structures and dynamics review, and that goes in parallel with your aerodynamics process. So you do your aero design, and then you do checks basically on the structural, so basically solids and dynamics, you know, does it vibrate and is it going to cause some failure due to vibration? You do that along the way to make sure that you're not going to get into failures. Those are kind of the well-known ones. And then a third area that also a lot of people don't talk about is really manufacturability. Along the way in your design process, you need to make sure that what you're actually designing can actually be manufactured, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to design an impeller or a machine or a blade or something that then turns out it's impossible because there's no machine or no technology available that actually can be used to manufacture it. And that goes along with materials. So manufacturability and materials kind of falls into the same basket, where you review your materials, your coatings, et cetera, along the path of being able to can you actually make this design that you've come up with.
Yeah. I also would like to point out, you know, as engineers, we don't design these machines out of thin air. There is usually a use case, a customer, a market assessment that says, okay, we need something that fits certain requirements. This could be, I need a gas turbine that makes 20,000 horsepower, or I need a compressor that can run for a given casing size more throughput than what my competitors can do, things like that. And then you go into that process where engineering gets asked, hey, can you guys do that? And then of course somebody asks you also invariably, can you do that at a cost that makes this project feasible? And yes, Klaus is absolutely right. That is sort of that basically marks the playground. And then within this playground, you go from a, let's say, rough draft where you use the experience that you have to more and more refined concepts. And at the end, you will have some CFD simulations. And you will have, once you build the first machine or the first prototype, you will have some testing.
Yeah. And as Ryan mentioned, CFD. So there is a number of tools that you utilize along this design process. And some of those are very modern tools. You know, there is finite analysis, computational fluid dynamics. And these are commercially available. And some of them we call them gold standard kind of tools. And then there is a lot of other little pieces of software, some as little as like a spreadsheet kind of thing. But there is literally hundreds of little software tools that are going into the design process, because every single thing that needs to be done in the design process needs to be evaluated, right? Things as simple as like, how do you put an impeller onto a shaft, tie bolts, torques, all that kind of stuff. For all of that, there is some engineering equations that somebody developed or experience that somebody developed. And usually those experiences get put into some kind of software analysis tool. And it's kind of funny to say, but when we design machines, we use very modern software, but there's also some software that we use that's a 50-year-old Fortran code that somebody wrote in the 1970s, and it's still very useful and it's still very accurate and still being used nowadays. So there's quite a bit of experience that goes into it. It's not just the big software FEA and CFD analysis, but a lot of other little tools that go into that.
Yeah. And that's really an important statement. A lot of people think, oh yeah, so you dream up something and then you put it in the computer and you get the results. The CFD modeling or the finite element modeling or the things like that, that's just the last step. There's a lot of experience and a lot of reduced order modeling in the widest sense that comes long before the time you actually run CFD or some other computational tools.
Okay, so you're talking about these analytical tools. Can you kind of explain what they do, what a finite analysis, element analysis, or CFD, or rotor and blade dynamics, and explain what each tool does?
Yeah, I mean, in the broadest sense, they simulate physics, right? I mean, you have a physical phenomena, which may be a rotor that is vibrating and bending and moving in its support structure, which are bearings. And you need to make sure that those vibrations, those bending modes, don't exceed certain limits where you're going to get into, you know, where you get rubbing of metal to metal, or where something breaks, or you get high cycle fatigues, or where your bearings are overloaded. And so those are basically, that would be rotor dynamics. So you're simulating the physics using basically advanced mathematics. Similarly, blade dynamics, you're modeling the physics of how blades vibrate. Then you have computational fluid dynamics, which is looking at the fluid dynamics, which can be very, very complex in turbo machinery. And which is actually so complex that even with modern tools that we have, it's really hard to model an entire turbo machine. You still really, in most cases, only model a part, like one impeller and its channels around it. You rarely ever model an entire machine. And then even within that, you look at steady state and transient analysis, where transient analysis is a lot more complicated. And then there is finite element analysis, and we call it finite element analysis. It should really be called structural finite element analysis or dynamic finite element analysis. But when we talk about FEA, finite element analysis, we usually refer to the analysis of the dynamics and the strengths of structures. Although, you know, CFD in the sense is finite element or a finite difference analysis also, but FEA usually in our area refers to looking at the structural and dynamic analysis. So all these types of analysis are done in a progressive way. So you usually start with a 1D computational fluid dynamics analysis. It is still computational fluid dynamics because you're solving the equations of motion of the fluid, and then you get into a 2D analysis, a little more detailed. and then you get into a 3D CFD analysis. Similarly, you start with a very coarse structural analysis where you just calculate some hoop stresses on a wheel, and then you get into, okay, a more detailed geometry finite element analysis to see where your stresses are highest. Do we need to reinforce something? Do we need to change the geometry, et cetera? And once you've done that, then you get into blade dynamics and you look at interference. You know, do we get excitations, fluid and structural dynamic excitations that can cause blades to vibrate? And so that's also done using some finite element analysis usually. And then finally, usually that's also done in parallel, you look at the rotor dynamics of the machine, because when you get into very long shafts, you get some bending modes that can cause some problems. And you got to run at a speed that's reasonable for the rotor that you design. So those are kind of the basic analysis. But as I mentioned before, there's also a lot of little analysis tools that have to do with manufacturability or how things fit together, how much axial movement is allowed, how much thrust you're generating, all these things that have been just generated over time that also need to be utilized. And most of those tools are actually very specific to each manufacturer, whereas, you know, we may have one, some of our competitors have very different codes because their design practices are different.
I just want to reinforce something here real quick. For example, take computational fluid dynamics. So the equations that completely accurately describe any fluid flow, I can write down in about 5 lines. And that describes everything. The only problem is that you cannot solve these equations analytically. So you have to use more and more accurate approximations of that. That is computational fluid dynamics. And no matter whether you do 1D, one-dimensional models or 2D or 3D models, a lot of the use of these tools depends on the user's experience and depends on test data that you have for similar cases. When we hire new employees who basically may have a degree, for example, in aerospace engineering, then they often have this idea. So you give them a box of a new CFD program, and then without any further ado, allows them to design new impellers or new airfoils. That's not true. None of these out-of-the-box programs without some additional knowledge on what you have to do will get you to a proper design.
All right. Yeah. I mean, basically, we use our CFD and FEA codes and everybody else based on a lot of experience of many years and knowing how these codes will provide answers given our experience, right? If you just take a CFD code or an FEA code and you try to develop a turbine machine, you'll usually end up with garbage in, garbage out, right? Because you're not, you don't know what's actually the right boundary conditions and when the code gives you junk without knowing it that it's junk. So it's really many years of experience plus experimental validation of these codes that make them valuable. Without that, these codes would be just black boxes without any intelligence.
And the other thing that needs to be understood is, I mean, you may ask yourself, so why do you do first some global analysis, then a one-dimensional, and then you go into more details? Why don't you just run a CFD code and get done with it? The problem is, how many variations can I play through, let's say, in an hour, in a day, or a week? With 1D, I can literally, if I write a program around it, I can literally do thousands of different variations within an hour, or actually in reality within minutes. Whereas once I have a full-blown CFD code, let's say for my entire machine, that may be computing times that are measured in weeks. So the only thing that takes more time than a full CFD code is actually building the machine and putting it on a test stand.
Yeah. I mean, typical computational types, I mean, we use large computational clusters, so many, many nodes of computers that are running in parallel for doing CFD analysis. And even on those, we're talking days for analysis time for some of these very complex models that are transient and full 3D geometries.
Okay, so I have several follow-up questions. Maybe we start with, you had mentioned, you know, you hire a new person to come in, you kind of give them this box of software and stuff. So are engineers sufficiently trained on these tools, and are they also sufficiently trained in the fundamental physics that these tools simulate?
Well, the answer is no to both of those, right? So it's really kind of weird in a sense, because on the one side, you have the fundamental physics, and these tools, especially if you look at CFD and FEA analysis, they've become so advanced that you really need an advanced degree to even be able to capture part of what some of these technologies are capable of doing nowadays, right? So you cannot have an expectation that somebody with a bachelor's degree in engineering has a full understanding of what a complex computational fluid dynamics code is capable of doing, including turbulence models. That is not taught, at least on a bachelor's degree level. Similarly, the usage of these codes is not taught, because there is very little university courses where they actually take one of these codes and do a lot of applications with them. So, I mean, traditionally, a bachelor's degree is a professional degree, and then you have a master's and a PhD degree, and those are supposed to be more academic and more in-depth type of degrees. But the reality is that with a bachelor's degree, you neither get the sufficient teaching of the physics, of the fundamentals, nor do you actually get the understanding on how to operate these codes. And so a lot of that then has to come back to on-the-job training, right? Especially the usage of these codes takes quite a bit of time, and how to utilize some of that experience that companies have gained over the years and transfer that to a new employee, a young engineer, that just comes through experience with on-the-job training. The fundamentals understanding of the physics, it's either self-learned, or it's because somebody's got a PhD or at least a master's degree in an area that is more specialized, such as fluid dynamics and FEA analysis. Obviously, the number of disciplines that go into the design of a turbo machine, which is structural dynamics, materials, fluid dynamics, rotor dynamics, all these things, they're beyond the knowledge of a single person. So there's not a single engineer who can handle all this. And so the turbo machinery design, such as everything else nowadays, becomes a team effort where you have multiple disciplines that need to work together to design the machine.
Part of the problem is when you teach that stuff, that a lot of, for example, fluid mechanics is, right, at the end of the day, to get from the first principles to some workable code is basically math. In fact, actually, a lot of the early CFD codes were written by people who had degrees in math, not by people who had degrees in engineering. So the real training that you have to give new employees is to understand, you hope that they understand some of the first principles that are underlying like a rotor dynamic analysis or a CFD analysis, and then you have to train them in understanding, for example, to judge whether their results are reasonable, and what they can do to the actual design to make something work better than what they had when they started with the analysis. And that is really the part that's probably or very rarely possible in a teaching setting. And that is really one of the things when you hire new people that you have to train them to understand these things.
Yeah, it's really what Rainer is saying is almost wishful thinking, right? And that's why, I mean, a good turbo machinery designer, you know, you don't get them after 1 or 2 or 3 years out of college. They usually take 10 years and then they become reasonably good. And then after 20 years, they become experienced. And then after 30 years, they're so experienced that they don't believe anything is possible anymore. And then they become useless, right? So it's kind of sort of the path of learning that we all go through in our careers. But unfortunately, a lot of these advanced tools then kind of sort of easily turn into black boxes where we over-rely on them and we kind of get used to, okay, I can put something in and something comes out and it's going to give me the right answer. And that's where that fundamental knowledge of physics needs to come in that is usually not taught, at least at an undergrad level, but is really critically important to realize when the results that one sees from these black boxes are garbage. And that's very important, but it's still happens, and that's why sometimes we get very fundamental problems in our design process because of mistakes like that are not caught.
Okay, so I think maybe the burning question, if you will, is, you know, back in the day when the computers were less powerful and these computational tools weren't as advanced or they didn't exist, how did they design compressors and pumps and turbines?
That's a wonderful question. Because they designed them and they were just great too. Now, obviously, they may not have been as efficient and they may not have been able to run as fast and they didn't optimize, you know, for structural strengths and they were maybe over-designed on certain things. But there is a point to be made that we sometimes over-rely on analysis tools when we design things. I mean, the obvious example is the design of a turbo machinery skid. Turbo machinery skids have been around since the invention of the steam engine in the 1780s, when you had a steam engine sitting on a big metal frame and the thing was shaking like crazy. And over the years, turbo machines, both reciprocating and rotating machinery, have become more advanced. But people have been designing skids without any finite element analysis and without any computational tools forever. Nowadays, it is nearly impossible to get anybody to design a turbo machinery skid without wanting to do a detailed finite element analysis of its dynamic modes, etc. And they spend lots and lots of time doing beautiful FEA models. 40, 50, 70, 80 years ago, we designed skids and we didn't have to have FEA. So it's very easy to become reliant on these tools to the point where you do stupid things, where you use them for things that really don't need to be used. We see the same even with fluid dynamics, where we see the reinvention of a pump passage that was designed 20 or 30 years ago, and somebody says, oh, I designed something, and you look at it, and that looks exactly like something we designed already 30 or 40 years ago. And by the way, it has the same efficiency, the same head, the same flow. But they used a new tool to do the same thing. So there is an over-reliance on that. But on the other hand, you also have to give credit to these tools that machines have become a lot more efficient, which is good. And they use less material and so on and so forth. So there are, they provide the opportunity for advances, but sometimes it's
stupid. You can actually, we cannot lose sight from the fact that you can actually, with hand calculations, get sort of the rough outline on how the blades of a machine are supposed to look like. It's a bit easier with turbines than with compressors, but that's basically how the first machines were built. And let's not lose sight of the fact there were a lot of failures in the early days. In fact, actually, whenever you start pushing envelopes, whenever you extrapolate what you're doing beyond on what your experience levels are, there is a chance that it's not going to work. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we do testing. But the sort of the very general layout, what Klaus talks about, the 1D design, the earlier forms of these 1D designs you can use on basically with a pencil and paper. And that's what they did.
Yeah. You see, it's always fun when you go to a science and technology museum. Some of them have old turbo machines on display. If you go to the Smithsonian in Washington, close to the airport, they have a bunch of old gas turbines on design that were, you know, World War II or just post-World War II designs. And you look at the airfoil shapes and of the compressors, and there were even some turbo pumps there. And they're very similar to what we would design nowadays. They may not be quite as complicated in their shape, but they're very similar. And so these guys did not have any of the finite element, CFD, etc. kind of tools that we have, but they were still able to design some very advanced turbo machinery without any of those tools. So again, it's great to have these tools. They allow for a significant advancement in efficiency, power reduction, and so on, for better machines. But it's also easy to make use of these tools that look at them like a black box without thinking about it, which has then led to significant design failures too.
And I mean, you have to give it to the use of these tools. Let's say, picture yourself standing in front of an airplane and looking into the inlet of the engine. You see some very complex blades that are twisted and turned and sculpted and all of these things. They look fundamentally different from the from if you were to look at an engine that were designed in the 50s. And they are much more efficient. That is something that really was only possible by using these tools. But the fundamental idea on the components of a gas turbine, how they are roughly looked like, that's actually been done for a much longer time than these very complex tools were available.
Yeah, and I have to agree here with Rainer. I kind of said these designs look like similar now and then they look post-World War II, but you're right. I mean, if you looked at the aerodynamic design of an advanced fan or even a high-flow compressor impeller, you have beautifully shaped designs that look more like 3D sculptures than they look a turbo machine, but they have been optimized for a necessary function, and they reach incredibly high efficiencies that we would not have been able to reach without those tools, obviously. And so there is significant potential for advances. And we're still, I mean, every turbo machinery manufacturer still continues to try to improve their impellers. That's an ongoing business where we try to squeeze the last 1% or 0.5% of efficiency out of an impeller given a certain flow capability.
Okay, that wraps up part one of our podcast on the design process of turbo machines and various engineering tools that are used to design these machines. So thank you, Klaus and Rainer. Be sure to tune in next week for part two, in which we'll talk about how accurate these tools are, and given that there are errors possible, what benchmark testing is required, and kind of the current gold standard or state-of-the-art tools that are in use right now. So thank you to our listeners for tuning in today. I'm your host, Alyssa Espinoza, and we will see you next time.